Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, we've got Latif Matima from Howard. We've got Colette Vogel from Without My Consent. And Evan Brown, of course. We're going to talk about servers in the sky, cyber civil rights. And you may own your Facebook password, but Facebook owns the word book. Next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 155, recorded March 30th, 2012. Life, Liberty, and Keg Stands. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey folks, Denise Howell here, and I am so excited to bring you This Week in Law this week because back by very popular demand is Colette Vogel. Yay! Much applause. Hi, Colette.
Great. How are you doing? Back. Thanks. I'm great. It's been really fun up here in the Pacific Northwest, and it's really fun to be back on the show. It's been a while, so
yes.
Excited to talk with you guys.
Great to have you. Now, I'm not sure if the flurry of emails that I've been getting to have you back on the show is going to come to a stop or if it's just going to ramp up because now you've been back and people are just going to want more and more and more now that they've gotten their fix. But either way, it's great to have you. I'm glad you could make the time and join us.
Thanks.
Also joining us from the International Institute for IP and Social Justice and Howard Law School is Latif Matima. Hi, Latif.
Hey, how is everybody today? It is such a great pleasure to be here, to finally be a part of this fantastic program. As, of course, you know, one of my colleagues here on the faculty, Steve Jamar, he had the privilege of doing the show a few weeks back, and he's just raved about it. And so, you know, I'm glad that as the director of the Institute, I finally get my turn.
Yes, it's great to have you. And we really enjoyed having Professor Jamar. Thank you for lending him to us a few weeks back.
Indeed.
We're thrilled to get you on as well. And also back with us today, by constantly and ever-present popular demand, is Evan Brown.
Well, that's really nice of you to say. It's a real pleasure to be here. Looking forward to this conversation. Colette, great to talk with you again. Really should be a lot of fun. And Professor Matima, you and I first met about 5 years ago at a seminar. You were actually one of the planning chairs. It was an event back in Washington, D.C. about internet law. So really, really have look forward to connecting with you again and talking about this really interesting stuff today. So really glad to be here.
Oh, well, great. Yeah, it's definitely great to connect up again, particularly in this type of a format.
Right on.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we have a... Go ahead, Colette.
I was going to say, if I could jump in, I have not met Professor Matima before, and so I was kind of excited when I got the list from Denise about what, you know, who's going to be on the show. So I'm excited to learn more about your organization and what you all are doing.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. I feel like I'm being welcomed into esteemed company.
Yes, as are we. So the mutual gratification now behind us. Let's jump into the very interesting stuff that we have to discuss this week in no particular order. Let's start with the DMCA. We have touched on the fact that Google has filed an amicus brief in the Hot File case. Having looked at that a little more deeply, I thought I'd just toss that out there because there are some interesting ramifications to what Google is doing and what the 11th Circuit might do with that case. So I think we should maybe chew over that a little bit before we move on to other stuff. There are a couple of key issues that Google has jumped in and wanted to have some impact on when the 11th Circuit rules. It has not yet interpreted these particular portions of the DMCA. And what's at stake here is what sort of notice a service provider like Google or like Hotfile in this particular case has to have in order to be made ineligible for the safe harbor protections of the DMCA. What sort of measures they have to have in place to qualify for it, and what sort of activity can be going on the site, what sort of red flags need to be presented to the organization running the site before the safe harbors are stripped away from them. So Google obviously wants and other providers of online services where users submit information, and some of that may be infringing stuff. They want these provisions of the act to be construed in such a way that the service provider has to have very specific notice, and that notice, the onus of the notice, is put on the rights holder, so that they are the folks in the obligation of policing what's going on in the site, more so than the site itself. And that goes back to the legislative history of the DMCA and the fact that the safe harbors are designed to let services function and not be crippled by the fact that infringing activities may be taking place on the site. So let's toss this out and see, you know, what you guys think about the importance of this case. Colette, let's start with you.
I have to say, first of all, and we didn't actually talk specifically about this before the show, Denise, but because of my role at Microsoft and I work in the copyright team, we follow these things very closely, but I'm sort of constrained in being able to comment publicly because I worry about people misinterpreting my personal thoughts or my thoughts as statements on behalf of the company. So I need to be a fairly kind of high level in talking about these issues, especially as they relate to copyright. I'm also obviously here, and as the little thing underneath my name shows, you know, mostly here representing my nonprofit organization that deals in privacy stuff, and I'm happy to talk in detail there. But the main big issue with this hot file case, I think, and Google's effort to point some specific things out and get involved in the litigation in an amicus way is exactly what you're saying. It's this line between what is red flag knowledge and what is actual notice, and does the statute require those things to be different, mean different things? And it's going to be very interesting how this works out, and also how the Second Circuit interprets those things in the Viacom YouTube case that's pending. And you know, any day I hope we'll find an opinion coming out on that. So,
right. Professor Matema, I'm sure you follow these things pretty closely. Do you think that this 11th Circuit hot file case is going to be an important one? And do we have any indications of where it might go?
Yeah, I think it has a great deal of potential to be a very important case. And I think that both as a matter of, you know, just strategic application and just in making certain that the law continues to move and develop in the direction that was intended when the DMCA was passed, I think it was very prudent that Google and other entities who just want to preserve the DMCA framework interject themselves into this litigation, because I think, you know, as lawyers, we all know this. Oftentimes, egregious conduct can result in bad law. It's not so much that the court is deliberately going off in the wrong direction, but sometimes when you have really, really bad facts and you really want to send a strong signal to that particular party and perhaps other players in a particular industry, that type of conduct is not the kind of conduct that we want to see. Well, sometimes you can end up overdoing it and making some really, really, really broad statements. And I think that is, at least from my perspective, one of the things that is central in this particular particular litigation. What you have with Hot File is you kind of look at what they did. You look at the fact that there, you know, appears to be some encouragement of people engaging in particular types of questionable activities. Kind of, you know, are you sort of deliberately turning a blind eye? And what you don't want to have happen is enunciations and interpretations of what the requirements of the DMCR safe harbors are that are really more directed towards trying to deal with this particular defendant and they're possibly just turning blind eyes and encouraging people to engage in infringement activity that ends up indirectly watering down the protections of the DMCA, because it's very, very clear from the legislative history and from the statute itself and from Judge White's opinion in the a religious technology case that we all know was pretty much provided the blueprint for contributory and vicarious liability issues in this context, that there is not supposed to be a responsibility to monitor on the part of ISPs, that it is the job of the copyright owner to police the internet, to police her work, to monitor, and to give clear, concrete information to ISP owners that, hey, my work is being infringed. This is who, what, when, and where. And now and only now does the responsibility shift to you to do something about it. And so when you have a player like Hotfile engaging in conduct that a court might find inappropriate, you don't want those bad facts, so to speak, to result in a shifting of that balance such that eventually you whittle away from this absolute clear directive that ISPs do not have the responsibility to monitor and to police.
There are a couple of interesting facts about Hotfile that come up in this case that may wind up impacting the court's analysis. As Professor Matema was saying, that, you know, sometimes you get a court wanting to reach a certain outcome, and maybe Hotfile is not the best poster child for everyone who has sufficiently crossed their T's and dotted their I's in operating a service like this. One of the things that Hotfile failed to do was to have in place a monitoring system for repeat infringers, or for even detecting repeat infringers on the site. And another thing it failed to do until I think it was after the lawsuit was filed was have a designated agent for notices under the DMCA. And one of the things this causes me to think of is, you know, perhaps they were, the coverage that I've read of this says they were in business for approximately 15 months before they designated agent. Mm-hmm. And my heart kind of goes out to startup companies and certainly to individuals who might be operating some kind of web presence where third-party content and contributions are involved. That just maybe, you know, I mean, you really, really do need to know what your obligations are under this statute in order to take advantage of its protections. And having a designated agent is an important thing. Evan, I toss it out to you. Do you think that maybe this is an instance of the law not taking into account the fact that individuals and startups just aren't legally savvy enough to maybe comply with some of the requirements here? Or do you think this is such a minimal requirement that that's okay?
I think you started to read my mind there at the very end mm-hmm. of your questioning. Yeah. We've talked about things like this a lot. And, you know, I hear what you're saying. And there, the law and procedures and all of the things that you have to do when you're starting up a business do add a lot of burden to the business, to the entrepreneur, whether that be a startup or somebody in mid stage or whatever. It's hard to run a business. There's a lot of things to do. There's more things to do than what there are hours in the day to do them. But getting a designated agent on file with the Copyright Office has to be down there with among the simplest things that you do to be an online business that stores and serves up user-generated content. It's literally a one-page form where essentially you fill out your name and address and email address, and then I think it's $105 now. So although that's, you know, more than a coffee at Starbucks, that's certainly not something that's going to break the banks of most people, even startups when it comes to that. I don't think that there's many people who will listen to an argument that $105 filing fee and a one-page form is going to really keep somebody below the entry barrier for you know, starting up an online business. So, but at the same time, yeah, there is this sentiment that, you know, there are things. Because there are so many things to do, and this is not something that's obvious. It's not like, you know, getting the, you know, perhaps certain licenses that a lot of business owners in the brick and mortar world have to do. It's one of those things that could easily be overlooked. But given the fact that the DMCA is so critical and is so important to managing the liability for an online company, I don't have too much sympathy for a company that would fail to do that. It would be unfortunate to see, you know, its existence rise or fall on the failure to do that. But at the same time, I don't know how much real sympathy we could give to them for not doing that.
Professor Goldman has a lot of good information out there for individuals who might be bloggers or otherwise, you know, not in a position of having a big infrastructure around them for compliance with this particular portion of the DMCA. Let me put you on the spot, Evan. Have you designated an agent for internet cases, for example?
No. And I'm not really worried about it because I guess I do allow comments on some and I shut those down after mm-hmm. a while automatically just as a spam prevention thing. I am not worried about my liability as an infringer that's occasioned by user-generated content, because really the only meaningful way somebody could even try to infringe by using my site would be to copy some text into a comment. I watch those very closely. I would remove it very soon. So I don't think a copyright plaintiff in that situation would be able to prove that I was liable under, you know, the framework, either as a direct infringer or as a secondary infringer, you know, under some kind of vicarious or contributory or inducement theory. So and this is a point that I stress, it seems like almost every episode, just because you, as a service provider, you don't comply with the DMCA safe harbor provisions doesn't mean that you automatically lose if somebody sues you for infringement. It just means you can't avail yourself to that affirmative defense that Section 512 provides. So the reason that I don't go through the process of designating an agent is because I can't afford the $105. Well, I don't have the time to fill out a one-page form. Wait, am I just canceling it? I love it when I'm self-negating like this. No, the point is I don't worry about the principal liability, you know, to worry about the second. But, you know, I'm just a you know, humble little blogger over here in my little corner of the online world.
The information that can be shared in the comments on your site is qualitatively different than what Hotfile is up to. Colette, did you have a comment?
I think so, yes.
If I could jump in, you know, because I totally agree with Evan. It's not something that every blogger needs to do, but even on a site that doesn't have user-generated comments, there is a part of the DMCA that covers linking liability. And there are ways to interpret it as if you're providing links to other content that might be infringing. As much as we'd love the world to be very, very clear that links are not infringing, I think there are there are some situations where it would be nice to at least be able to argue the defense that I'm not liable because, hey, I have an agent. It's mm-hmm. You have notice, you can send me a note and I'll take that link off my site. So I think some websites might benefit, even if they don't have user-generated content on their site, by having a designated agent if they're providing lots of links to other resources and other places on the web. And it's sort of a very conservative reading, believe me, very conservative reading of linking liability. But I see no harm, and why not give yourself the opportunity to argue that defense if someone came after you for some sort of secondary liability argument under copyright?
Yeah.
And you know, if I could jump in again, too, this is also the reason why I think that this case is so important. In other words, what you don't want to have is precedent that allows people to begin to whittle away at the DMCA with these sort of very strained, convoluted interpretations of what allows you to have the DMCA safe harbor. That really is predicated upon pointing to some very isolated, egregious bad act conduct. You know, I know one of the other parts of the case, for example, is focusing in on whether or not is there some way to utilize an inducement allegation to turn that into a basis upon which you would no longer qualify for safe harbor protection. And one of the arguments in the case is that, hey, no, look, the DMCA, it is supposed to protect you from all forms of secondary and contributory liability. And inducement obviously falls into that category from the perspective of, you know, clearly if you're inducing, you're not directly infringing, right? But the problem is that if you have really, really bad facts, and it looks like this party is really egregiously, affirmatively, I mean, just standing out on a street corner with the keys to the Xerox machine and saying, come on down and infringe as much as you like. You know, it's that sort of behavior that could motivate decision makers to misinterpret what the safe harbor provision is all about. And so it's those types of things that if you just sit back and you say, well, I'm not going to really worry about this situation because this is just a bad actor, you could end up with language in the opinion that later on will come back to haunt you. And then you find that there's precedent on the books that enables a content holder in a subsequent circumstance to argue at narrowing the availability of the safe harbor protections in contexts that no one really was thinking about, but you know, utilizing this broad sort of language that comes out of these bad facts.
Right. It would be a very big deal if the 11th Circuit came out with an opinion that said, okay, well, this particular actor was akin to the defendants in the Grokster case and mm-hmm. induced infringement, and we're going to go mm-hmm. that route. And since there's liability there, they're ineligible for the DMCA. No court has said that yet, right. And that would be a big deal. Evan, any thoughts on that point?
Yeah, I really think that that's an interesting point. And you know, I'm going to try not to get too concerned about I'm much more concerned about this now that we've had this conversation. I wasn't worried before. I was just all relaxing.
Yeah.
But you know, with this contributory liability theory that, you know, they're arguing over here with the plaintiff saying that if you are a contributory infringer, you don't get the benefits of the DMCA safe harbor, it seems plausible that that could kind of loop around and take care of itself, because what is one of the key issues here is the knowledge of the provider. And even Google is arguing and I love the language. I don't know if that was just in the TechCrunch piece that we read, kind of thinking about this, which is a great piece by Daniel McKenzie. Great summary of the legal issues. I don't know if this is his language or if it's actually in what Google said, but it talks about these red flags that they have to be brightly colored and actually waving in the provider's face for there to be, right. you know, any kind of actual knowledge on the part. It seems to me like you have that one person has a hard time saying with a straight face that that a provider would have a hard time saying with a straight face that so what? We were a contributory infringer, yet we should get DMCA protection, because how can you say that you are a contributory infringer and then say that you didn't know that people actually came and did what it was that you induced them to do? You know, it just seems kind of like it would kind of take care of that knowledge element itself if you are shown and you actually do, you know, concede or whatever, that you are a contributory infringer. Because you got to remember that Section 512 provisions are an affirmative defense, which means procedurally in the course of pleading and defending yourself and all against this stuff, you say, yes, I am an infringer, or I could be liable for this infringement. But that's not... I'm taking on the burden of showing through this affirmative defense afforded me under Section 512 that is okay, even though I am an infringer, it's okay. That just seems like kind of internally contradictory to say I yes, I induced people to come in Fringe, but yet I still didn't know about it. That's where it really starts to strain for me. Even though I love the DMCA and I love the provisions, and I hope the 11th Circuit comes down on the on Google's side and all this, it just really starts to get a little tenuous for me. When it comes down to logic on that point.
Yeah, and it could well get tenuous for a court.
Yeah, and of course, not to stretch it for too fine a point on it, an actual circumstance in which that could happen would be if let's say I'm weakly inducing, I'm saying, sure, we love to have user generated content, right? Now, implicitly, I kind of understand that there may be some people, or there may even be a high likelihood that some people are not going to pay close attention, and they're going to include in what they are considering user-generated content, copyrighted content that doesn't belong to them. And so they, put that up on my site. Well, the thing is that the fact that I am generally aware that people are sending up user-generated conduct, and if I really thought about it, I could say, well, statistically speaking, there's a probability that at least X percent of those people are likely to do something that is going to constitute direct infringement. But nonetheless, does that awareness constitute actual knowledge, the kind of red flag waving? You see, now I know that's not, what Evan is saying, but I think that it's that type of bootstrapping that Google and other entities are concerned about, that later on, the type of factual assessment that one would make purely in an inducement context could later be used to argue this sort of maybe it's not actual knowledge as the DMCA originally intended, but it should count as actual knowledge because you really can't make this argument with a completely straight face.
Yep.
Yeah, this is all really interesting stuff, and I'm glad we've gotten the chance to chew through it. As Evan mentioned, Daniel McKenzie's article at TechCrunch is awesome. It's called Hot File is Out Cold, but Google's DMCA Safe Harbor debate is heating up. I encourage you guys to check that out, and you can see that and all of the things we've been referring to and prepping for this show at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/155. And let's go on to talk about someone who is a classic inducer of copyright infringement, the Pirate Bay, because they're doing something that I find quite interesting and delightful and whimsical in some ways. They, have been raided and had their servers shut down at various times in their existence. And now they're going to try something that they call, their language here. It's pretty extraordinary, and they call it, we have now decided to try to build something extraordinary, and they are relying on the availability of GPS-controlled drones, far-reaching cheap radio equipment, and tiny new computers, and they're going to attempt to erect an unkillable cloud by hanging servers in the sky, launching computers into low orbit. In fact, it's called the Low Orbit Server Station. And that's where they're going to store and route your data. They're front-end servers, they say, that then route you to even more secret locations. So Pirate Bay is certainly out there fighting the fight to make sure that people will have a system on which to infringe. And that they conclude their blog post on this by saying all the parts we'll use to build that system will be downloadable in their own right. So but what do you think about this, Professor Matema? Do you think, first of all, I think it raises some really interesting issues on the subject of jurisdiction and against the backdrop, too, of of all the domains that have been seized lately and shut down. So chime in on that, if you would.
Yeah, when you said jurisdiction, it was as if you were reading my mind. I mean, I would hate to have to take the case and argue the jurisdictional issues because, it's in the old days, just, before we had Zippo, The arguments or the issues centered around the fact that, well, where does jurisdiction lie on the internet when the internet is everywhere? This, of course, ramps up the situation, because where do you have jurisdiction where the server, it's not everywhere at once, it's just as constantly moving. So that of course would just be a nightmare. I guess what one would have to do is to do something like in the early domain, the Topin cases, would be to argue that you have purposely availed yourself of virtually every jurisdiction, because you have sent this up into orbit, knowing full well that at one point or another it will be over any place. Right. So mm-hmm. It will certainly, you know, so that I guess that would be the way to go after it. On a more general, IP internet front, obviously, you know, this is just a bad idea. The reason why I say that is primarily because, you know, it's this type of extremist behavior that makes it so difficult for parties who are really trying to engage in legitimate fair use and those types of activities, or legitimately attempting to iron out some sort of framework in which folks can engage in what digital information technology and the internet allows us to do, you know, to move us away from this paradigm in which some of the established content industries just absolutely insist that, you know, any use of our content whatsoever, you know, we're just going to chase that down. You know, it's like the Al Pacino's character when he played Capone in The Untouchables. You know, if anybody does anything against me, I'm going to kill him. Then I'm going to kill his wife. Then I'm going to kill his kids. Then I'm going to kill his dog. You know, it really is this type of extremist behavior, right, that sort of adds fire to that sort of response. Because every time that someone stands up and tries to argue for some sort of sensible middle ground, you know, come on, you know, this person is accessing this material in order to do a limited public interest documentary. You know, this stuff really ought to be fair use, and to whatever extent it's a little bit outside, let's not have a fit, you know, about that. It gives the other side, you know, examples to stand up and point to and say, this is why we have to be so extreme, because look at what we're fighting against. People are infringing on satellites and sending them up into outer space. What else can we do but be extremists? And so that's the reason why I think it's such a bad idea. It just keeps us in this polarized debate over internet use of protected material.
Right. And of course, the flip side of the infringement argument about what the Pirate Bay is up to is that, you know, as someone in IRC just said, torrents can be legitimate. Extreme speech requires extreme measures. And we've actually had a judge in Florida reach a ruling here that BitTorrent downloaders may have some degree of protection over under the First Amendment from phishing expeditions because of their free speech rights. So it does bring a couple of things into conflict there. Evan, any thoughts on this?
I wish that we could talk about that Florida case, but if you, this may have been updated just in the last day or so. If you scroll all the way down to that piece, where was that? It was on Torrent Freak, wasn't it?
Yes, you're right. At the bottom, the ruling has now been vacated.
Yeah, the judge signed the wrong order. He signed the proposed order that the defendants, you know, submitted to the court. So wouldn't that be great?
Oh my goodness.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Well, briefly, right. Torrents were entitled to free speech protection.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, go ahead, Professor.
No, all I was going to say is that, and of course, that's not the first time somebody made that argument. You know, back in the Universal, what is it, versus Remedies case, that sometimes, you know, this is conduct as speech. You know, I choose particular material to infringe, and that's my message, right? So clearly, this judge I guess didn't read that opinion, right, when the court struck that down. But it is a fascinating argument.
So actually, Evan, we're not quite sure what the status of this. I just pulled up the order. They vacated the order that apparently they signed erroneously, but then set everything for a special hearing. So it doesn't look like there's any order in place at this point.
Yeah, and you know what? To be honest, I'm kind of glad that the judge didn't issue that ruling because, you know, when it comes to anonymity, and I realize this is a huge topic that Colette will talk about, you know, at length later in the show or whenever it's going to become appropriate here. But you know, when it comes to unmasking an unknown defendant who is accused of copyright infringement, it really seems difficult to say that there's much of a First Amendment interest in anonymity, given the framework that we have for unmasking anonymous speakers in other contexts. When, for example, the defendant is accused of defamation or something like that, because the First Amendment analysis goes to this balancing interest or balancing test to weigh the First Amendment interest to speak anonymously versus the right of the plaintiff to seek redress. And no matter what standard you look that the courts have applied, it always has to do with the strength of the claims that the plaintiff who's seeking to unmask the defendant brings to court. And, for example, the Cahill standard out of, is it Delaware or Connecticut? One of those says that you have to bring enough facts to court to survive a motion for summary judgment. In a copyright case, it's really easy to plead all the elements that you need to show to prove a copyright case. You just got to say, I own this copyright. I have the registration and the defendant, I have evidence here that suggests that it infringed. So suffice it to say, I'm glad that the judge didn't rule the way that we thought that he did there for a little while, because I think the First Amendment analysis in a copyright case is really, it's the same analysis, but because of the way that we plead these things, should almost always come out differently than the anonymity evaluation for other kinds of cases like defamation or invasion of privacy or something like that.
Okay, Colette, anything to say about servers in the sky and or torrents as free speech?
Yeah, the servers in the sky, when I saw that, it reminded me of the movie, is it called Pirate Radio? Mm-hmm. With Philip Seymour Hoffman. It just reminds me of all these jurisdiction things. Like, let's go put the radio station in the middle of the ocean so that we're not subject to any state or country's laws. And now they're just taking that to the next extreme. And I have to just, agree wholeheartedly with Professor Mietma's thoughts on that, because this inability to have a real discussion about the real problems and the real ways that service providers and content owners can work together to solve some of these copyright problems get really muddled up with the extreme behavior that happens in some situations that just makes it difficult to have a real conversation. And I think we saw some of that play out with the SOPA PIPA debate in the more recent months. And it's happening also in Europe and in other parts of the world where these discussions are happening on the policy side and they can't have a real discussion to get down to the brass tacks. So the people who can, are kind of stuck because they have these other constituencies. They can't do anything publicly that might be seen as extreme in one direction or another, or agreeing with someone that might be seen as extreme. So I think that that's a real serious problem and something I hope we can get past in these policy debates on that front. On this free speech thing, I'd love to talk about anonymous speech if we would like to head in that direction. Evan's absolutely right that, in the defamation world and when you want to unmask somebody for saying something defamatory, there is some very good law in numerous jurisdictions. And I think we're seeing a trend that hopefully it will be applied in many more, that if you want to unmask someone who has said something anonymously online about you that you believe is defamatory, you have to get over some initial hurdles to get that person's name and identity. And I agree that that's actually very important. There's a lot of opportunity for chilling speech when the speaker knows that they're going to be easily identified and chilling important speech. So we want to make some due process barriers before you just rip the mask off and say who the person is. That said, copyright infringement is something that's very easy to allege and plead, and it is an area where we need to be thoughtful in what standards we apply when we seek to unmask somebody. So it will be very interesting to see what this judge does in the end and where that case leads. So happy to talk more about that if you'd like.
I would. In fact, I do want to go deep with you on your panel at South by Southwest and all of those issues. In addition to, we've got a whole lot of other interesting stuff about Facebook standing up for users protecting their passwords and at the same time and in the same week changing their terms of service to prevent users from using the word book and lots of other fun and interesting stuff. But I'd like to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law before we go too much further, and that is Netflix. Netflix, as I'm sure you probably know by now, and if you don't, this is going to be a great opportunity to remedy that. It streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means you save time, money, and hassle. There are so many easy ways to instantly access all the streaming movies and TV shows that are available on Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your Mac or your PC or your iPad. And the iPad app is just invaluable for when you're running around like we all do these days. You can watch on your phone. Again, that's with you all the time, your iPhone and some Android phones too. If you have a gaming console as part of your entertainment system, an Xbox 360 or a PS3 or a Nintendo Wii all work great with Netflix. And you can watch Netflix right on your TV using any of those tools and several others. If you're not a gamer, you can use a Roku box. They're inexpensive and easy to use. There are a lot of great options out there for bringing Netflix into your living room. And once it's there, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any of those devices. And you can begin watching a movie or show on one device and finish it on a different one. However you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel anytime. So try it today for 30 days, absolutely free. Go to netflix.com/twit. And when you use that URL, you tell them that we sent you. We greatly appreciate that. And we greatly appreciate Netflix's support of Twit and This Week in Law. Thanks so much, Netflix. All right, Colette, you went to South by Southwest, and I don't think any of the rest of us did. You had a fascinating panel there on the issues you were just touching on before the break. So why don't you tell us a bit about that and what your takeaway was from that?
Absolutely. Happy to. So I was really excited to participate in this panel. Cindy Cohn at EFF is a friend of mine and also somebody that I respect greatly in law and in this area of civil liberties and free speech. And so she approached me and asked me if I'd be willing to debate her on the question of should my social site permit 100% anonymous use, meaning, you know, Should my social site have any form of tracking so that someone later could come back and find out who the person was who's defaming them, or can they use pseudonyms? Do they have to use real names? All the whole spectrum of anonymity online. So I agreed, and I said I would wear the hat of the, you know, no, you should really have some form of accountability on your site is how I look at this problem. And so I think about how would I articulate to a business person who's setting up a social site to, you know, what are the benefits and some of the cons, the pros and cons of having some form of identity on the site, such that if victims of harassment or defamation or other things would have a way to obtain that information if they need it. And it's a hard, I think it's not that hard of a problem, but it is a hard problem to get over some of the, how do I put this? to get over some of the resistance, because I see the very deep importance of anonymous speech when you think about the problems in the Middle East and places where the blogosphere and other forms of online media have really made it possible for people to communicate in parts of the world where speech is not permitted to be so free. So I'm very sympathetic to some of those issues and allowing for communities of people to get together and talk and solve problems without having to, you know, put their identity forward in every instance. And whistleblowers are another good example of that. But that said, I think there are very good reasons for a social site, a site especially intending to build on the community of its users, to have some form of accountability. And the main thrust of my argument was that it's good for your business. It brings in the right kind of people to your service, especially if you want to have a safe place for as many people to appear and be online as possible. And it's morally the right thing to do, because it enables an opportunity for people who have been harmed to get to the information, provided they can prove some of the baseline issues like we were just discussing about unmasking. You know, you have to have a legitimate defamation claim, or you have to have a legitimate privacy claim, or whatnot, to get that information. And it's the right thing to do as a company. And, you know, I wouldn't go as far as advocating that we should pass laws that require this, require intermediaries to hold information and all of that. But I think there are very good best practices and very good reasons why sites online should do that. So that was the gist of the debate. Cindy made some awesome arguments against that, and the audience was really had really some excellent comments and questions. The audio is available on Lanyrd. I think we have a link to it on our Without My Consent site on the resources page. If anyone wants to go back and listen to the full audio, it was an hour long panel. About the last 20 minutes was questions from the audience. And for me, the biggest takeaway, and the hardest question to answer, is when people talk about online harassment, which is something Without My Consent, I mean, that's the whole focus of our organization. We have a hard time convincing people that this is a real problem. And it just sometimes totally shocks me that that's so hard to convince people, because I feel like I see it all the time. Mm-hmm. It's around me everywhere online. And maybe I just, because of the things I do and I'm interested in, I'm seeing more and more. I see it all the time. And of course, the people I used to help when I had my private practice, you know, I saw some of the most horrific and egregious things that I can't believe just happen and people are doing, you know, people are subjected to. So what came out of that is we really need good, strong data to support the point that this is actually happening. And in my follow-up blog post after the event, I kind of put a call out, and I'd love to say it here too for anybody who's listening, people in the social sciences, anywhere, if you have research that you've done about the frequency with which online harassment happens, the victim, like who makes up the victims and who makes up the perpetrators? Who are these people? Can we draw some conclusions about who's being harmed and who's finding that this conduct is acceptable and think they can just do this on an ongoing basis? I'd really love to get more of that data. There is some data. And Danielle Citron, one of our advisors, is actually had written a post about it as well and pointed to some data. And her book, I think it's called Hate 3.2, will be coming out in the next year. And that will also talk about you know, the problem and documenting the problem as well. But anyways, that's sort of the summary.
Really interesting to me against the backdrop of what we've just been discussing with the Pirate Bay servers in the cloud and copyright infringers perhaps being more savvy or less, I don't know, emotionally spontaneous perhaps than the harassers that you're talking about, Colette. Because if someone wants to cover their tracks online, they certainly have the ability, if they research it a bit, to do that. And it seems like folks who are going to go after someone in a cruel way online don't necessarily take those precautions, or, you know, they're not particularly savvy about what they might do. to take extreme measures like Pirate Bay does. Professor Matema, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, you know, I think there are some really, really interesting tensions, obviously, because on the one hand, you don't want to chill speech. And on the other hand, you don't want to promote things like, you know, cyberbullying and other forms of Internet harassment. I think, you know, whereas in the brick and mortar world, we had certain practical ways of dealing with this sort of a problem. I think that there are ways to transfer that to the Internet context. I mean, again, as you just pointed out, in some ways it's easier for one to mask one's identity in the Internet context. First off, you know, there's no face-to-face if you don't want there to be. And then secondly, you can, you know, mask IP addresses and do all of these sort of interesting things. It seems to me that a more, I don't know, for lack of a better word, common sense approach is for us to begin thinking about, well, you know, what is it that we want to discourage and what is it that we want to promote? Well, we want to promote the kind of free discourse of ideas, you know, whether we think the content is popular or not, right? Whether we like the ideas or not, that's what we want. And what we want to discourage is bad activity that pretty much, I mean, most of it would just simply be illegal anyway. So it seems to me that importing some of that traditional balancing at the do we grant the subpoena to remove the mask, that those are the kinds of things that I think that we should be moving in the direction of having courts weigh. In other words, all right, what you are alleging, are you alleging facially illegal conduct, right? If so, are there some affirmative defenses that we ought to listen to first before we make the decision as to whether or not we should unmask the speaker? I think in the IP context, particularly in the area of copyright, it seems to me that courts can do a little bit more in terms of looking at the affirmative defense of fair use before you go forward and you unmask an identity. Because if I am sued as an infringer on the basis because I've posted some material, one way in which you can chill my legitimate First Amendment right is if you know that basically what I did, it's obvious that I posted it, but this falls under fair use. Well, if you sue me anyway, because you know that there's going to be a lot of time and money and expense, et cetera, well, that could be one way to chill legitimate speech. I think if at the beginning stage, if courts pay more attention to simply saying, well, first, let me see if this appears to be facially infringement, because as you know, as Evan pointed out a little bit ago, it's not that hard to allege, you know, this is my work. I have the registration. It was up on XYZ date and I didn't give them permission. In a way, maybe to balance it and to protect the First Amendment interest, you got to make it equally easy on the other side for the person who, yes, I posted without permission, but I have a legitimate First Amendment and fair use right to do so. So let's just at least listen to my basic fair use facts, which I can lay out, you know, relatively easily. And then, you know, we should take it from there.
All right. Evan, any thoughts on this issue before we move on?
I'd like to just pick up on what the professor said just then. I think that's wonderful in principle to build into the analysis this question of fair use as a defense that a John Doe defendant could raise at the very beginning. I'm really dismayed to report, you know, most of you know this already, mm-hmm. that the courts seem to be going in the exact opposite direction in these cases with where the plaintiffs, oftentimes their porn companies, are suing thousands of John Doe defendants who are accused of trading BitTorrent files online. Some courts, I think it was there in the District of Columbia, where the judge wouldn't even listen to the petition to intervene by the John Doe defendant, saying essentially that if you, and this was one of the lawyers that used to work for the, like, was a lobbyist for the RIAA, I think, back in the day before she was on the bench. She said, I'm not even going to listen to anything that you have to file unless and until you tell me who you are. And it's then we can actually start talking about the merits of the copyright infringement case. So I'm really dismayed to see that despite the way that Professor Matema's approach makes eminent sense and really should be the way that it is, that the courts seem to be going in the exact opposite direction. Maybe this is a situation where some bad facts have made bad law because, you know, I don't know. Maybe they're not such bad facts. That these are just, you know, copyright infringement cases. If anything, it seems like the pendulum should have shifted away from these crazy litigation tactics that the plaintiffs are taking. So that's something that's troubling if you stop and think about it.
Right. And of course, you're right, because bad facts, it's porn. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, when you are without authorization engaging in porn traffic, those are the kinds of bad facts that lead to these types of bad decisions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. If I could just jump in, there is an interesting thread, and actually a long thread of procedural law about proceeding anonymously in litigation. And it applies both to defendants and to plaintiffs. Part of what my organization is trying to do is to educate more lawyers about the fact that you, if you want to bring up as a plaintiff, want to bring a case anonymously, especially when it involves very private information, there are methods to do that and to bring that to the court's attention before or at the time that you file a case or are brought into a case. But the same kind of theories also apply to defendants who need to have and maintain their privacy. And I think in these porn cases, I think a lot of them dealt with gay porn, and there were people who were accused of copyright infringement, and the method of the plaintiff is to kind of just shake them down and get some money out of them, but also at the risk that they would be exposed as porn consumers and also exposed as gay porn consumers. And that is a real threat. And I think that some of those defendants, if these cases are moving forward, I haven't followed them in that level of detail to know, but their attorneys can seek a protective order and can seek to proceed anonymously for those kinds of reasons. And I think there are probably some very legitimate arguments. And I was just going to look for it, Denise. Maybe we can send it in the show notes later. There was a recent decision about proceeding anonymously as a defendant that was fairly positive in that regard, and I just need to track it down. And I think it's really important. It leads to a really interesting situation where you have a lot of people potentially in our court systems, in our public court systems, using our resources that are anonymous or pseudonymous, we could say. And that raises its own sort of transparency and free speech related issues, certainly for the press. I think the press may have some resistance to that being the case. But there's precedent, and there is not terrible law, I'll say, on those fronts.
Not terrible law. That's good. So it seems that the FTC is concerned about maintaining the privacy of all of us online users who, you know, presumably are not engaged in activities where our privacy needs to be discarded so that we can be gone after as defendants. It has issued a new report that's basically kind of a policy statement. It doesn't really provide any concrete parameters for what should be done, but it does have some recommendations for providers putting privacy first and building in privacy by design in their services, offering better transparency, and offering choices, including do not track, which the FTC appears to like. And they did a short animation when they issued their report. I think we have that queued and can play it. Colin, if you could. Talks about how we leave little bits of data behind in our daily lives. All right. Well, Colin, let me know when that's ready. In the meantime, we can talk about the best practices that the FTC... Wait. Here it goes.
and more. When you use these services, you're sharing information about yourself with friends, with businesses, while you're out and about, while you're at home. That information is shared and sold within businesses, with their affiliates, with ad networks. So on a typical day, you might shop at a store and use a loyalty card to take advantage of a sale. And your shopping habits may be shared or sold. You might need to fill a prescription, and your prescription history may be shared or sold. You might use a daily coupon app to get a deal at a nearby restaurant, and your location information may be shared or sold. You might visit a news site where you notice an ad for your favorite brand of shoes. It's an online sale, this weekend only, so you buy a pair. And the articles you read and your shoe preferences may be shared or sold. You might log into a social network and see that your friends are filling out an All About Me quiz. You get the quiz app and share your answers, and your quiz responses and profile information may be shared or sold. A regular day. You've taken care of business, used some free services, gotten some good deals, and revealed all kinds of information about yourself. So at the end of the day, the question is, who has your information, and where is it going next?
So I like that the FTC is at least paying attention to these issues and is helping people realize as they go through their day how much data they are leaving behind, and they don't even raise the subject of, you know, the various surveillance that we're under throughout our lives and where that data goes. But just the affirmative commercial acts that you do, or the things that you input into social networks and how they can pile up and become somebody else's business plan. So again, I don't think the FTC has done anything terribly concrete here other than to pay attention to it and encourage businesses to give users some choices. Anybody think that perhaps the FTC, is this just a PR gesture on their part, or will it have some actual meaning? What do you think, Professor Latima?
I think it's a nice start. I mean, I think that it's rather than going from one extreme to the other or being, you know, needlessly, you know, politicizing the issue, I think this is the place to begin, to sit down, to raise some awareness both on the part of the consuming public as well as within the business community that, hey, listen now, we're in a world now in which people engage in everyday ordinary activity and they do leave an information trail behind. I mean, when I was in college and in law school, I did research, I flipped through books, and whatever books that I flipped through, if I didn't check that book out, well, there was never any record of the fact that, you know, I looked at these cases or I browsed and I decided, you know, I needed a break. And so I secretly looked through Cosmopolitan magazine. There was no record, you know, of that. Well, you know, today there's a record of everything because that's just the state of technology. And I think it makes sense to say, let's be careful. Let's think about some things. Let's not wait until a few bad actors really run away with the train. Let's start suggesting some ways to think about it, to analyze it. Let's start putting some best practices together. And on the flip side, the other thing that I like about not forging ahead too fast is that if we go to the other extreme too quickly, we just simply say, no, you know, you can't look at any of this stuff. You can't use any of this. You know, because at my institute, we like to focus on some of the marginalized communities that typically aren't included in these discussions. I like to think about the way that the policymaking will affect some of those groups. And so, for example, you know, if we were to move to a situation in which, okay, I have these services that you might be interested in, but the only way you can avail yourself of it is if you ask me first. Well, in some cases, you know, some people, they just don't have the background, access to the information, the sophistication. They don't even know what questions to ask in the first place, right? So they certainly need some of these services, but they would not know that these services exist. They would not know how to articulate the questions in the first place. And it's not until someone approaches them and says, hey, listen, you know what? It seems to me that you could use some information about alternative education opportunities, or you could use some information about entrepreneurial advancement and economic empowerment options. And so, you know, if we were to go too far too quickly to the other side, folks who could benefit from somebody, you know, again, using the internet and digital information technology the way that it is best used, that someone who could just knock on your internet door and say, by the way, would you be interested in this? We wouldn't have that. So I think that this sort of let's take a look, analyze, come up with some best practices, see what happens, you know, and then come back and refine. I think that this is a great way to get it started.
Colette, are you concerned that Do Not Track, which the FTC seems to be getting behind here, could damage the efforts that you're pursuing at Without My Consent?
I don't think so. I don't know. I mean, I think that one of the ways to enable pure anonymity, the real anonymity, and enable people who've been harmed to obtain the relevant information. One idea that has been proposed and debated and will continue to be, I think, is a concept called notice and track, where a site isn't required to maintain information about their users until they receive a notice that this person has been doing something illegal. And upon that notice, then the intermediary would be obligated to do some sort of tracking and maintaining of logs around their IP address or whatever level of tracking is involved. And if the bad conduct continues, then the person who's been harmed can then get the information they need to pursue their case. And that proposal has some interesting, I mean, it has some very interesting issues. And certainly intermediaries are very reluctant to be in a situation where they're obligated to maintain data. But as I think it's no, you know, it's true. Many of them are already holding some of this data. And I know that Cindy Cohn at the debate and others are very concerned about obligating them to maintain data for periods of time, because that data is then obtainable by governments and could really be used in a way that could harm freedom of expression and political activism and things like that. So I haven't really thought about Do Not Track from the perspective of Without My Consent before, because I hadn't actually seen the merging. Maybe it's also because we have like 20 million other things we're trying to chase down. But it's a really interesting way. It is an interesting thing. I hadn't thought about the impact on our efforts.
I guess the thread I was pulling together there is that if you're tracking, that's just, you know, another body of information
to go after.
Exactly. And to the extent that's shut down, then perhaps there's less to go on.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
you know, on the flip side of that, if you're someone who's engaged in criminal or other unlawful activity, just taking a do not track option shouldn't provide that great of a shield for you under the law. I mean, it's not a blank check. Any thoughts, Evan?
Yeah, I mean, on that, what you just said there, I mean, I don't think that would really be the intention of Do Not Track,
right,
to shield you from, you know, the particular things that you would do online to get in trouble. Because if you think about, you know, online crimes, they're usually pretty discreet things, you know, trading a file that contains child porn, you know, harassing someone, doing whatever. What Do Not Track protects you from this, the power that the big data you know, collectors and whatever, everybody who has all that stuff has this picture of you in the composite. At a more general level, I mean, you know, I really like this animation that the FTC did. It really explains it just as well as anything I've ever seen on, you know, the various pieces of information that can be put together about you. But I still just can't get past this irony that was kind of implicit in what Colette was saying. I guess she was actually reporting on what Cindy Cohen was saying in the debate, was, you know, this is the government who is, you know, we've got the FTC, you know, kind of warning us of these problems and saying how important it is to protect us from the disclosure of too much information and the thoughtless collection of information about us and the dissemination and sharing of all that. But this is the same government that would also want to have more and more information kept about us in the form of server logs being kept longer, the NSA wanting to track down terrorists and all that stuff. So, you know, there's just this fundamental strangeness about the government doing that. And I've said that before. when it comes to, you know, solving this conundrum or this problem, there really seems to be there could be some kind of economical component to it, because what we have here is so many services that are available to us for free on the internet because we, in return, share our personal information for that. You know, Facebook is as great as it is because it gathers so much information about us that it can then use to customize the target for advertisers to hit when they want to you know, utilize that platform. So it seems to me that the best solution for all of this would be to somehow reimburse the users if they opt in for the disclosure of this information. And this is by no means a new concept. You've got, you know, this is what they were talking about with the attention trust, you know, six, 7 years ago, of, you know, since the information really does belong to the users and it's to the benefit of the platform provider in having that information, isn't there some kind of way to make this equation that the advertisers kind of front more of the cost, front the cost for this information from the users, and that they're given it up for, you know, something of greater value than just the convenience of, you know, Facebook being free and all that stuff? It seems like there could be a stronger economic component to it to equalize the balance of power that
right,
that
and,
arises
and certainly
from
more control on the user side as to what's being collected and by whom and how it's being used. Definitely things we'd like to see come to pass. So thanks, FTC, for paying attention to those issues. Facebook is paying attention to its terms of service in some interesting ways, using them as a bit of an aggressive way to go out into the world. First off, apparently Aaron Egan, the chief privacy officer over there at Facebook, and folks on, now I'm not sure if Aaron is a man or a woman, sorry, folks on Aaron's team have come out with a statement about some of the cases that we've covered on Twill over the last several months, where people have been asked by employers or potential employers to turn over their passwords so that they could go rummaging around in their Facebook account and see about their personal activities. Facebook doesn't like that and points out that it's a violation of its terms of service to reveal your password and have someone access your account who's not you. And they've said they take your privacy seriously and will take action to protect the privacy and security of users, whether by engaging policymakers or, where appropriate, by initiating legal actions, including by shutting down applications that abuse privileges on the site. And I assume, you know, if you're going to violate Facebook's terms of service by being an employer who's accessing someone's account in this way, Facebook would not bat an eyelash at denying your own Facebook privileges. So, you know, if it's important to you as a business to have a Facebook presence, and I think it is, that's something you should be well aware of. So interesting that Facebook has taken this stand. I guess there was actually some legislation that was proposed that got shot down in the House very rapidly after its introduction, that would have added new restrictions to FCC rules that prohibit employers from demanding workers' social networking usernames and passwords. That did not get added. But still, you know, Facebook taking a stand that it's going to use its terms of service to make sure nobody's violating them in this way is an interesting thing for them to do. Colette, do you think this is a good idea?
Yeah, I think it's very much in Facebook's, it aligns with Facebook's interests to stick their neck out on this one. I mean, I think it's crazy. If an employer wanted my Facebook account information as part of my onboarding or my pre-screening before getting a job offer, I think I'd just be very turned off by the employer. But not everybody's in the position to say, oh, no, you know, I mean, jobs are scarce and people need to, you know, get them. And if that's a condition, people may feel very, very much in a tough spot to not turn information like that over. But I just find it to be very creepy. I mean, I was reading that article. There's a quote from somebody in the ACLU about, you know, would you let them come over and read all your mail, your physical mail? Mm-hmm. I mean, I get some weird physical mail that I'm like, why am I getting stuff from the AARP, you know? but there could be other things. And yeah, I just find it really shocking. So I think what Facebook, they probably had a good sense that this would be a good PR. This would spin out fairly positive PR. It's also very much in line, from what I can tell, with, of course, that their goals, which are in large part to have as many people using the service. And if people are worried about this, they may not use their service.
Professor Matema, what do you think about Facebook riding to the rescue of the rights of users this way?
Yeah, this one for me just sort of had me just doing a whirly gig because just so many different issues here. You know, first off, I mean, obviously, Colette, you're right. I mean, this is Facebook just basically shoring up and protecting their business model. I mean, you know, obviously, no one has yet argued that it would be somehow impermissible to Google a person. Right. And you can find out a lot of things about many people by just Googling their name and, you know, all sorts of statements that they've made, photographs that people have taken of them. You know, when you click on the images icon or what have you, because we kind of think that, well, that's public information. I've put that out there. Of course, Facebook, I guess, is sort of quasi-public. I mean, you've put it out there, and the real issue is, well, I've decided I want to put it out to a particular group of people, and if I can no longer control how wide that group is, does it mean I'm not going to engage in certain activities anymore? Probably not. What it probably more likely means is that I'm just not going to talk about them on Facebook, and of course, that makes Facebook a little less attractive. I think the most important thing out of all of this for me that really is what got me just sort of interested in this whole issue is that actually this is sort of a problem that in the African American and other ethnic communities and similarly marginalized communities, this is something that we have been focused on and trying to get courts to pay attention to for decades. And that's the issue of covert bias and covert discrimination. Someone asking what appears to be a facially innocuous question, but having some sort of impermissible and, in fact, possibly even illegal motives in asking the question in the first place. It is something that we have labored under for quite some time. There were cases in the 80s and 90s in which, you know, documented circumstances in which employers and recruiters were caught. You know, later it was revealed that if you had an ethnic sounding name, you didn't get an interview. Right. And of course, if you are a racial minority, people can always find out that information about you at the interview. They don't have to look at your Facebook page to know those things about you. I think what this does is that it may finally get our courts and our nation to look at the question of covert bias, I think, finally, in an intelligent way. And that is that the mere fact that a person doesn't come right out up front and say, I want to look at your Facebook status because I want to find out what religion you practice, that we've been looking at these issues in a way that oversimplifies what actually happens. You know, I don't know that I personally am convinced that we should go so far as to say that being a Facebook subscriber puts you automatically, per se, into a constitutionally protected class. I'm certainly not going in that direction. But by the same time, by the same token, I think that if this sort of inquiry is going to begin to get the average everyday person to think a little more carefully about how is it that constitutionally protected information and aspects of their lives, how do employers and other institutionalized actors, how do they access that information and how do they make use of it in ways in which it is not facially illegal? Let's think about that question and whether we're talking about it in the context of a Facebook or a broader, more socially significant context, for example, you know, interviews. If that's what this is going to lead us to having a dialogue on, then I think that, yes, good, let's go ahead and have that dialogue.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to think about this in, you know, this has come up with Facebook and the instances that have been in the news seem to have involved Facebook, although I think social networking passwords in general have come up. Mm-hmm. But when you move it over to the context of something like Google, where, mm-hmm. you know, it has the social networking component, but yet there's so much more that mm-hmm. the Google services cloud provides mm-hmm. people, you know, documents, mail, search, of course, mm-hmm. and the whole host of other services that they offer. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I think an employer would think twice before asking for somebody's Google account password, but maybe not. Mm-hmm. Evan, do you think that that changes things at all?
No, I don't. Okay. And, you know, just for fun of it, I'm going to take the side of the employer in this. if anything, because I just like to get tomatoes thrown at me from the IRC. No, for the sake of having a conversation or dialogue about it, I will try to articulate the position of the employer in all this. And that is the courts have been almost uniform. I'm going to say the courts have been uniform in holding that the information a person puts on a social networking site is not protected by any kind of privacy interest, like, for example, the Fourth Amendment or any kind of freedom from harassment or whatever, in those contexts. So we put this information out there. We don't have an expectation of privacy in it. And so if we look at, you know, the interests of the employer of why they want to look at that person's Facebook, their social media information, they're trying to determine the merit that person has to do the job. And, you know, it's very easy to just say in the abstract, well, what they do outside of work is irrelevant to how they will perform at the job. Really? If the person is in a habit of staying up drinking until 2:30 or 3 o'clock every morning and posting pictures of themselves doing keg stands on Facebook, which is not a constitutionally protected activity, shouldn't the I guess it is a constitutional protected activity, but it's not like a Title VII kind of thing. shouldn't the employer know about that? Because that's definitely going to have an impact into the employer's resources that they invest in this employee. There's all kinds of data out there that show that it's very harmful to employers. It hurts companies' bottom lines, and by extrapolation, it hurts our economy when there's a big rate of turnover. For employees, you know, when a person is there and they either underperform or have to leave and you know, through attrition, have to be replaced or whatever, that's a big cost. And it's something that could contribute to the sluggishness of our economy. So what's wrong with allowing this vision into information which the courts have said is not protected by any privacy right for mm-hmm. the purposes of evaluating this candidate, looking at information that is perfectly legal, perfectly lawful to ask about? There's mm-hmm. nothing unlawful if I'm interviewing somebody to work for me. Do you stay up late drinking? Do you smoke? Do you do whatever? You know, a lot of things that you could ascertain from the person's social media account that you could ask them, and then they probably wouldn't give you the honest answer. Yeah, there may be information there that would subject the employer to a Title VII lawsuit, but, you know, what's to stop the person from seeing that I'm wearing a ring on my left hand? Or if I practice a religion that has me wear particular clothing or certain jewelry or something like that? You know, it just seems really It seems a bit too brusque to just cut the line off and say, thou shalt never have the right as an employer to look at into a person's social media accounts, whether it be the Google account, that broad information, or Facebook for sure.
But can I just say, we operated in a world where this wasn't a problem for century or more than that, where employers didn't have this information. I mean, they might know that the person's down at the pub, I guess, at the corner if they have if they're concerned about a drinking problem or something. But, you know, businesses existed for years and years and years without asking for and having that level of detail. And now that it's just available, I guess, I wonder, that's just a cost of doing business in a way. And it will probably always be part of, you know, you could look at all of their social media and still not know that they're a serial killer. I mean, it's, I don't know that it's worth the trade-off. And I'm certainly, respectful of Professor his really great points about, you know, what the ulterior motives could be for asking for this information. And I'd rather protect a broader audience and have some employers stuck with some of the downside. And that, having been an employer myself not too long ago, you know, I realize it's expensive to do business, and there is costs in having turnover and having to train and everything. But I think that's a worthy cost from my perspective. I know you were just wearing that hat for the sake of argument.
Well, I blame the lawyers. I blame Sarbanes-Oxley and everything that makes companies feel like they have to do all this due diligence in order to operate, and that they need to dig into everybody's tiny little detail of their life in order to make a hiring decision. So let's let people have a little bit less scrutiny, I think. Another interesting thing, before we pat Facebook too strongly on the back for their change in, or their recognition that they're going to help users enforce their terms of service about password protection, they've also added something now to their terms of service that allows Facebook to more aggressively pursue what it considers its trademarks, including the word book itself. There's some language now. I'm not sure that it's actually gone into effect. It was open for a comment period, but it is certainly on the table for what's going to be in Facebook's terms of service. They require users, you may not have read the fine print on this point. Previously, you were restricted from, in fact, absolutely prohibited from using Facebook's copyrights or trademarks, including Facebook, the Facebook and F logos, FB, Face, Poke, Wall, and 32665, which I guess is what you use when you text to update Facebook. Now they've taken out the text numbering. I guess maybe they're not so concerned about that one, but added in book. So they're now saying that that is a trademark of Facebook, and you as a user have agreed, or will agree when these terms go into effect, not to use that term without the written consent of Facebook. So for everybody who wants to call something book or use the word book, I mean, when you're reading this broadly, it just says book. It doesn't say book as a suffix to something else. Then, yeah, if you're a Facebook user, apparently you're going to be in violation of terms of service. And that's something that could come back to haunt you in a trademark suit. Hey, you know, you agreed not to do this, in addition to just getting your Facebook account bounced, I suppose. So, you know, the lawyers at Facebook work in mysterious ways. Evan, any thoughts on this one?
It's fine. You agree to it when you sign up, right? So, you know, that it is interesting what they're trying to do to bolster their trademark argument and all this. I don't know that it would have much to do if there really was an infringement action, because we so often lose sight of the fact that trademark law is really meant to protect consumers and not the owner of the brand. As strange as that seems to brand owners and, you know, including Facebook, what's really at issue here is whether people out there in the consuming public are going to be confused as to the source of this new site that would spring up using the word book. So the fact that they're trying to bolster it in their terms of service may make them sleep better at night. I am skeptical that it would have much of an impact if somebody were sued for infringement for using a mark that was that included the word book. That, of course, is separate and apart from whether Facebook would choose to pull the plug on that particular user's account, which, you know, it clearly would be in the right to do. And I don't see much of an argument in favor of the user if it were to have its account terminated for violating that particular provision. So, you know, there's no reason we shouldn't be surprised by Facebook trying to bolster its position like this.
Right. Professor Matema, do you think that this would have any strong weight in an infringement case, a trademark infringement case?
Yeah, you know, I just found it interesting that, you know, because, you know, reading some of the stuff all together at the same time, on the one hand, you know, Facebook standing up and saying, you know, we're going to protect your privacy from these awful employers because we love you so much. And by the way, don't ever use the word book. I thought that was an interesting juxtaposition.
Yes, as long as you're not privately using the word book.
Exactly. You know, I agree with Evan's point. I think that, you know, when you get right down to it in an infringement cause of action, you know, what the court is going to look at, the court is going to look at the law. The court is going to look at, you know, sure, Facebook is a strong mark. This pretender to the throne, do we have likelihood of confusion? Do we have the basis for a dilution claim? And the fact that you signed off on something in terms of the terms of use, well, you know, that's between you guys. That doesn't bound the court. You know, the court still has to make its own independent substantive trademark assessment. I think what's really a little interesting is, again, you know, what Evan was saying, well, are you going to pull the plug? Take that a step further. What might a court do with that type of contractual agreement? In other words, if Facebook can't prevail on a trademark infringement claim, is it possible for Facebook nonetheless to sue you for breach of contract and collect damages for your breach? Which even gets a little bit more interesting, because then what are going to be the actual damages that Facebook would have suffered from your failure to live up to a contractual obligation that is basically worthless because they would not have won the infringement suit anyway. So I basically agree with everyone that, you know, this is sort of like a little tempest in the teapot, something that probably somebody in-house dreamed up and said, hey, what the heck, why not? Let's give it a spin. It gives us another arrow in the quiver. But as to how effective it's ultimately going to be, it's an arrow that's not going to travel too far, I would think.
Yep, I would think so too. Yeah. All right, we are getting down to where we need to wrap the show, and I'm so distressed because there's so much else juicy stuff I wanted to talk about. Let's try and get through some of it quickly before we wrap, if we could. First and foremost, Professor Matema, you have a really interesting position there at the Institute for IP and Social Justice about cyber civil rights being the next big forum for online activism. Can you elaborate on that for us so that we definitely hit that before we close out here today?
Yeah, great. Thanks. Yeah. You know, one of the things that the PIPA and SOPA debates, you know, really gave us an opportunity to crystallize something that we've been working on for the past 10 years. And that just has to do with the fact that when you look at the situation of various marginalized communities in American society, I think that the traditional civil rights activist approach to ensuring social justice and social equality, you know, really has not sort of caught up with the digital information society, and really has not focused on the ways in which, intellectual property law and information technology law and policy can affect political and economic and social opportunities insofar as those communities are concerned. So in a interesting sort of way, in a sense, we kind of welcomed the problems of PIPA and so forth. We were very much involved in the activities and the fronts to sort of defeat that that legislation, because it gave us an opportunity to crystallize for various entities on, and various segments of society. You know, well, what are the, for example, African-American community interests in IP law and IT law and information policy? And you had folks on both sides that, you know, when we stepped into the conversation and saying, well, we have something important to say here, you had folks on both sides sort of saying, since when? You know, I mean, you guys always talk about education. You talk about voting rights. You talk about Medicare. What do you have to say about IP? We didn't even realize you would even step up into this. And so I think that, you know, realistically speaking, now that we live in this digital information age, obviously from the days in which we talked about the original digital divide and the ways in which people could participate in the 21st century economy and political society, that we have to be a part of that. We have to have access to that. That was one of the reasons as to why the DNS blocking components of PIPA and SOPA, I thought, were particularly important to those communities. You know, when you block at that level, it overlooks the fact that there are people who share addresses because they can't afford to buy, you know, the entire address or the entire place on the server. And there are going to be certain communities that are going to be disproportionately impacted if you choose that means of dealing with infringement as opposed to some more surgical means. You know, it's very much like tracing illegal activity to, you know, an entire low-income housing project, you know, which there are multiple buildings. And instead of narrowing your address to the particular resident who's engaging in it, you just simply cordon off the entire housing project that may have hundreds or thousands of people living there. And you say, well, you're all going to pay the price for this person's individual bad behavior. So the chilling effect that that could have on digital entrepreneurial opportunities for communities that are really now getting their first opportunity to be a part of the situation, that really was something that we were very concerned about. In addition, coming at it from the other side, you know, some of the things that we have been focusing in on the last couple of years are things like athletes, both professional and at the collegiate level, their intellectual property rights, you know, in their images and their personas, and the fact that these IP assets are typically exploited in inequitable ways. They basically are cheated out of the revenues and the fruits of those aspects of their personas, particularly at the college level. You're required to sign it all away till the end of time and throughout the entire universe. It seems to me that that's sort of like a classic contract of adhesion. But again, you know, folks on both sides of the issue have to become aware of the ways in which these sorts of issues affect the civil rights mission in the 21st century. You know, another issue along those same lines is we're looking at the copyright termination battles, because this is a tremendous opportunity for various communities, particularly the African-American community, to reclaim their culture, their heritage, and just a huge amount of the entertainment product that content conglomerates have benefited from for decades, and that the individual artists and creators, again, were unfairly exploited. So that really is our focus, and I think the SOPA PIPA problem really helps to awaken folk in these communities, but also lots of other marginalized communities to begin to recognize that the battle now is taking it to the IP and IT front, and that's really going to determine a great deal of political and educational and economic empowerment advancement.
Yeah, it's where the expression and the communication happens these days. So it's definitely good that you're doing the work that you're doing. There's another related topic we're just not going to have time to get to today because it's way too beefy. But that's on the commonality and increased presence of arbitration clauses in online agreements that people click through and don't really realize that they're agreeing to those things. And we'll get to that in another show, but I think it's all kind of part and parcel. I do want to, since we were talking about SOPA and PIPA, give you our tip of the week, which is more of a decorating tip since I've been spending so much time on Pinterest lately, to make your home a more pleasant or humorous place. SOPA and PIPA has returned as toilet paper via a Kickstarter project. So definitely go check that out if you want to so equip your commode. And then our resource is actually another Kickstarter project, a film that someone is trying to make called Free and Open. It's a narrative series about internet censorship in the United States. They are trying to raise $52,000. They have $6,300 at present. So get on over there and check out Free and Open. Looks like it's going to be a good film and will be a great resource if it can get itself funded. So definitely check out those two things. And we're so glad that we've had the opportunity to get together today and talk about all of these great issues with Latif Matema from Howard. So great to meet you and have you on the show.
Well, thank you. It was an absolute pleasure to be here, and I'm going to just do what guests should never do and already say I hope you invite me back.
Oh, absolutely. We would be so disappointed if you would not come back. So hopefully we can get you back very shortly and pick up some of the threads we couldn't get to today. Also, great to always have back Colette Vogel, and hope you will join us again soon, too, as well.
I would love to. Thank you very much. It's been fun to be back.
All right. Great to see you again. And Evan, always great to see you.
Yes. Thank you. Great to see you too. And this has really been a fun conversation. I've really enjoyed it. Colette, great to see you again. Always awesome
Thanks.
To talk. And yes. And Professor, really, really enjoyed our conversation as well and hearing about what you're up to at Howard. So looking forward to the next time.
Great. Thank you.
Yes, me too. And until the next time, folks, find us on Google+ and on Facebook. We have pages there and love to hear from you about what you want to hear us talk about on the show. Any feedback you have about what we have talked about, you can also throw that to me at my email, denise@twit.tv. I'm over there on Twitter, D Howell. You can find me there too. And shoot me a DM or what do we call those things? A reply. Losing all my social networking terminology here in my old age. Anyway, it's been a great show, and I really appreciate everyone who's watched and everyone who's been here. So thanks so much. We'll see you next week.